That was somebody aiming.
Good morning, everyone. I would like to call to order the Joint Policy Committee, the Regional Planning Program for Friday, July 20th, 2012. I don't know what our quorum is, so. You want to do a roll call? Okay. Or you want me to do a roll call? Okay. I'm going to pass this around, but let's see if we, what do we need for a quorum, Dito?
We need 11, but we will start the meeting.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll pass this around. We have 10 individuals on, so we don't quite have a quorum, but we'll go ahead and get started. And I'm just going to pass the sign-in sheet around. And so we won't take up the minutes just yet, but we'll move into item number 3, which is the Bay Area Climate and Energy Resilience Project. So we'll look at the key findings and next steps from June 7th regional workshop and report preparing the Bay Area for climate change. Mr. Reardon.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm going to give you an update on the Bay Area Climate and Energy Resilience Project. We're doing updates this morning and key findings from both of the key JPC leadership projects, this one and the economic development that Sean will be talking about in a few minutes. I'm going to give you a quick update on the report that we're publishing, web publishing next week on our June 7th workshop on climate adaptation and on the Kresge Foundation grant that we're in the last stage of putting together. And then I'm going to just show you a little, some highlights from the report. So we're not just talking process this morning and updating you on what we've been doing, but actually showing some of the findings from the research report that we've compiled. Before I do that, let me just remind us all what is, as Mr. Sparing would say, what is the problem we're trying to solve here?
What is the problem? He asked the question.
Bruce has the answer. He has the answer.
So as you know, much of the adaptation planning and actual implementation will eventually be done by cities and by counties and in projects aimed at parts of our region. We have put together and are putting together a regional collaborative to help those cities and counties and help those projects that are working in subregions as we move forward, both in terms of planning and eventually in terms of implementation. And here are three of the things we're trying to do in helping the other cities and counties and all in the region. One, to help them from having to reinvent the wheel all the way across the region on adaptation planning. Small and mid-sized cities, and this may be actually true now for larger cities as well, simply don't have the capacity right now to do a lot of this kind of thinking and planning, so we can help with that. Some of the impacts from climate change are going to cross city and county boundaries, and some of the solutions that we come up with, if one city implements them, they will affect others around them, maybe negatively. So there's three, and then two more. Infrastructure, which we focus on a lot here, and protection of infrastructure from sea level rise and from extreme storms and all. Infrastructure usually is owned by a responsible party that we can look to and say it's their responsibility to take care of this, to protect it from various things that are coming. That's their job on an ongoing basis. But it's not quite so clear with our natural systems, the bay, our parklands, the ecosystems that are such a part of the beauty and the brand of the Bay Area. It's not so clear who owns those and who's responsible for protecting them. Same with public health. Public health is shared amongst a number of different players, and so it's not as quite as clear as it is with infrastructure, again, as to who's responsible and who should be doing the planning, who should be doing the implementation eventually. And finally, the state is now stepping in to provide some pretty interesting products, a local city's adaptation planning guide and some other things from the state level, products and services. But the state can do it much more efficiently if they work with regional collaborations. And we've started that with the state now, with San Diego and Los Angeles and the Bay Area and Sacramento, forming regional collaborations and making it much more efficient for the state to provide those kind of help that will eventually get to cities and counties. So here's what we're doing. Here's what we're doing. Here's the update. We are web publishing next week 3 reports, and I will send the drafts around if you just want to take a look. Maybe I'll start them that way. The first one is on research, summarizing the research on climate impacts in the Bay Area and in California where it's appropriate to the Bay Area. And we have probably a couple hundred reports that are summarized there. It's really an annotated bibliography. And web links to where you can find all of the reports. And the whole point was to put them in one place together. And then our next step, which will come in the next couple of months, is to boil them down to a coherent and compelling story about what's going to happen or what is happening in the Bay Area. So we don't have so many people on the one hand saying there's going to be 6 inches of sea level rise, and then you go to the next meeting and someone's saying there's going to be 6 feet. Or that it's going to be 105 degrees every day of the week in the Bay Area, and then somebody else saying, we're going to try and boil it down to here's what the summary, here's what the consensus view is on the science in the region. But this first part is just bringing all the research together in one place. Secondly, the second chapter is about the good news, which is all the projects in the region. There are some interesting projects that are being done by a variety of players in the region, and we have summarized them in Chapter 2 so that people can see the good news that these things are going on, and also we can form more collaborations and, again, maybe keep from reinventing the wheel so much. There are web links connected with each project to the information on the web that gives you more detail about them. And it's really a good story. Chapter 2 is a great story. And Chapter 3, then, is more educational, the kind of basic understanding of what are the potential strategies that we will eventually use. When people think about climate adaptation, they start asking me if we're going to change the weather or a variety of things. And Chapter 3 really brings it down to practical set of topics and a set of strategies that we're going to use on the ground to implement. So that's our report, and it's going to be web published, and we'll be sending it to you. It's good nighttime reading, I can tell you. Secondly, we had a June 7th workshop here in this room with over 80 participants. We had folks from all 9 counties. We had cities and counties. We had transit agencies. We had public health. We had conservation groups. We had ecosystems experts. We had UC Berkeley and Stanford. We had not enough business representation and not enough from the social equity communities. Those are 2 that we're working on. But a pretty good turnout, and they worked with us on our proposed 18-month roadmap. We're trying to take a kind of a short view here, since this field is changing quite a bit, and things are going to change, we know, quite a bit over the next few years. So we're not trying to lay out a 10-year plan or a 5-year plan, but take it in chunks. So they worked with us on our 18-month roadmap, and they worked with us also on, again, the beginnings of this compelling story about what is happening, what is going to happen in the Bay Area. And we did some project spotlights, and this is a photo from the workshop. So last part of the update. Kresge Foundation has invited us, after months of talks, to apply, and we are handing our application in next week, for a 6-month initial grant. We had proposed something bigger and more elaborate and more aggressive, and they said, let's slow down here, and we want to fund a 6-month program in which you really work with your stakeholder groups and build more support for the initiative and get more input from the various players and build that network more deliberately. So building on the workshop we just had, building on the various things we've done over the last year. So it will be a grant that will allow us to do a series of stakeholder meetings with a whole variety of stakeholders. So we'll go to transit agencies as a group. We'll go to public health workers as a group. We'll go to a variety of cities that have climate plans, that kind of thing. And we're going to be doing 3 things in each of the meetings: increasing support for adaptation. So we'll be talking about the need to do this kind of planning in the region. We will be asking the specific question of what do you need from us So, okay, we're inventing a collaborative. We think we have some good things that will help cities and counties and others who are doing the work, conservation groups and all, health departments. But we're going to ask them more specifically in each one of the meetings, what is it that we can do that can help you in the next 12 months, 18 months to move ahead? And also they'll help us shape then the overall roadmap and plan. Within the Kresge grant, we're also going to have three special work plans, one to organize the social equity issues and groups working on social equity issues in the region on the idea of vulnerable communities here, who's most vulnerable to climate impacts and how do we pay attention to those needs and those communities. The second special work plan, and we'll have a sub-consultant doing each one of these, will be where's the win-win here between GHG reduction, energy reduction, and adaptation? There are strategies that do both, and this work plan will identify those very clearly so we can get at them. The third special work plan will work to set up more of a system in the region for bringing the research in, but bringing researchers and practitioners and policymakers together. So we're going to come back with a work plan on how to do that and how to organize that in the region. Too often, research is over here, especially from our universities and all, and we're over here as practitioners. And we need to put them together and talk together about what are the needs of the cities and the counties and the regional agencies and the others who are doing this work, and how can the research agenda work more to inform the Bay Area's progress. Finally, there'll be a white paper on decision-making and governance, which is going to be very important to how we do this in the region. How do you take all that information and put it into general plans? How do you take that information and put it into the SCS? How do you take that information and put it into disaster preparedness? So that whole white paper will come back on showing us options on how possibly we can do that in the region. And the final piece, then this will all add together for the Kresge Foundation, is that we'll set up an interim structure that's better than what we have now around adaptation planning in the region and a 12-month action plan, so the next series of steps. So that's the Kresge grant. Let me just take a few more minutes then just to show you a few of the highlights from the Chapter 1 that we're sending around, then a couple from Chapter 2. And I'm going to focus only on the science that talks about what's happened already. You know, there's a lot of talk about what may happen, and there's a lot of work going on with modeling and projections, but these slides are all going to focus now for a couple of minutes on what's happened already. So you've seen this one before. This is rising sea level here measured at the Golden Gate between 7 and 8 inches over the last year. California is warming. And there are a series of studies. We have actually two here. On the left, a study from the Western Regional Climate Center, analysis of data that overall average annual temperature in California in about 100 years up a little under 2 degrees Fahrenheit. And then the map on the right is from NASA Earth Laboratory, where they've actually taken a 50-year look at this, not 100 years, but a 50-year look, where most of the warming has happened in the last 100 years. Most of it's happened in the last 50. And this shows differing areas around the region, around the state, and how they've warmed at different rates. So the warming has not been uniform, never has been, and it won't be. But as we warm as a whole, we're getting warming in different rates in different places. There's been more California warming at night. It's a little hard for you to see this one, I have a feeling. But the upper graph is the summertime maximum temperatures, and you can see it's a gradual trend line up over, again, this is a 50-year time frame. But look at the nighttime graph, which is the bottom one. This is consistent with U.S. figures. It's consistent with worldwide figures. It's consistent with what was predicted 100 years ago when climate change was first theorized, that you'd get more nighttime warming than you would daytime warming. You'd also get more wintertime than more summertime. And there are a variety of complicated reasons for why, but it's a very serious issue that we're getting more nighttime warming across the country. It's a health issue. It's a big-time public health issue. Because if you don't have air conditioning and you've overheated your body during the day, it's the nighttime where you cool off, like the city is supposed to cool off. We're not cooling off as much, and it's harder for people, especially without air conditioning. This is also an issue for agriculture. There's a whole section on agriculture on chill hours for fruit trees and all, that they need a certain amount of cold temperature. And so nighttime temperatures warming here in California and warming in the Bay Area is a significant thing. Yes?
Can you simplify at all why they predicted 100 years ago that we'd see this?
They had a theory then. And there are probably four or five different approaches now as to whether it's about clouds reflecting some in the daytime. It's about humidity going up at night, which they can document. There's a debate going on. It's really beyond my pay grade here to go further than that. But there's a set of things, and this is really a serious issue across the country. I'll show you another slide in a minute that will illustrate it. So here's Bay Area temps. We were talking about California. And it's mixed here, just like our climate is mixed here. We have a North Bay Water Association study that looked at 100 years and saw a significant warming in the North Bay, in the North Bay counties, in Sonoma and Upper Marin and into Napa. There was less warming in their study near the coast, makes sense, and more warming as you go further inland. Labasi was the lead author on a 50-year study looking at the last 50 years and saw a more complex pattern looking across the region. And I won't show you the map. It's kind of a big mess of squiggles, but basically cooler and low elevation areas near the marine layer coming in and warmer inland. We've had more warming. We've actually had cooling in some places in the region in the last 50 years due to marine air penetration, despite global warming. And Jan Knowles Weather Service did some 10-year look at data and found some cities have cooled slightly in the last 10 years here and some have warmed slightly. So a very mixed record in terms of the Bay Area. Here, this goes back to the question you asked about nighttime. The point I'm making here is that the longer time frames we look at, the better our data is, and the more sure we are of what's going on. If you look at 10 years, or you look at this year, there's a lot going on this year around the country. That tells you there's a lot going on around the country and not much more than that. It doesn't tell you much about global warming. If you look at 10 years, you start to see, you can see better trends, but it's better to look at a series of decades and start to see those kinds of trends. So the longer data frames are much better. This is one looking at the U.S., looking at record high temperatures that are set. You know, you see this all the time in the news. It was a record high today in Vacaville. It was a record high in somewhere else. Those by themselves just happen all the time. But for the 20th century, there were an equal number, roughly every year, of high temperature records and low temperature records. That's the way the system works. There was a certain amount of variability, and you had both. But as you can see from this graph with the red, which are the record highs around the country, that started changing in the 80s. It changed more in the 90s. It changed a lot more in this last decade. And we're now at 2-1. So across the country, you've got two record high temperatures being set for every low temperature, and that's a significant change across almost every region of the country. Precipitation. No overall trend here that we can see in the Bay Area and in California. This is total precipitation. You can see that just the red line is the smoothed out trend over 10 years, but you can see individual years going up and down. And we have quite a bit of variability in terms of precipitation in the Bay Area and in California. No trend over 100 years about total precipitation. And these are hard to see, but significant changes in the Sierras at the same time. And we're getting more rain and less snow in the Sierra. So the first graph at the top where you can see, again, it's a wildly, every year is different, but the trend line is down. That's the days with average temperatures below freezing at Tahoe City. So this is taking that part of the region. How many days do we have? And at the turn of the century, 100 years ago was about 80 days a year that you had below freezing at Tahoe City, and now you're down somewhere around a little over 50. That's a significant change. The other one is the snow that falls as a percentage of the total precipitation at Tahoe City, and it too has gone down significantly in the last 100 years. So we're seeing real changes in the Sierras. You can see them visually in pictures of glaciers. This study looked at seven different glaciers along the Sierra spine and saw, you can see from the graph, a significant reduction in some and a very significant reduction in others, again, over a period of about 100 years. So you can see the visual evidence that's going on in the Sierras, and all this is turning into a change in our water system that we're not quite set up for. We're okay now, but it's going to be a problem if this continues. The trend line here is less rain, less water available April, May, June, and July. That's when we get our big snow melt. That's when we need the water as we move into summer. That's when it's not usually raining here. And so this is one way they measure how much water is available for our summer months. What do we have available in these 4 months? And the trend down is worrisome. The trend down further will be more difficult in terms of managing water resources for both agriculture and for urban use. And this is happening because it's warmer and the snow is melting sooner. We saw those temperature records. And it's also happening because more of it's falling as rain than as snow. And so that water comes down in March or in February, and it doesn't hold it up there like it's supposed to in the big system. This is a significant issue. And last one, to make a point here, this is on wildfires as the example. These are complex forces at work, and climate change never works on its own. It's always working in combination with other things. So in terms of fires, this graph here at the top shows on Westerling's study on western fires how the frequency of large fires, forest fires, in the western U.S. is pretty directly correlated with the average temperature. On the really hot years that we have more large wildfires in the West, and that trend has been going on in this graph for 30 or 40 years. But there are a lot of things that go into wildfires. There are a whole set of things that are going on in terms of forest practices, forest management. Climate change is not the only thing going on here, but it is a factor and a significant factor here in terms of larger and more frequent wildfires in the West and in California. So those are just some examples out of Chapter 1. It's not all graphs and numbers in that chapter, and I'll show you quickly. You know, we're trying to look at what does this mean. It's not just numbers on the wall. Economic impacts for the Bay Area, this is from Roland Hull's study in 2008, that California would take a direct hit of billions per year from damage if we don't take action in terms of public health and agriculture and tourism and all. Economic impacts on the wine industry. There could be the warming in the Napa Valley and all could make a significant difference for our wine industry, which is a huge economic driver for our region. Health impacts. We haven't had a lot here yet, but we had our 2006 California heat wave, which was unprecedented in length, 6 days in a row of over 100, and in the Bay Area, we had Spare the Air Days there 6 days in a row, which I believe was a record at the time. It made a difference in terms of hospital visits. It made a difference in terms of measurable health impacts in the region. Ecosystem impacts. This is from the State of the Bay report. The future health of the Bay is going to be significantly affected, not just by sea level rise, but by droughts, cutting down freshwater flows, a whole series of things that are going to happen. And water impacts, you know, the Delta right next to our, adjacent to our, and in our region. You see the Joe Simidian quote here from the IRWIMP, the Integrated Regional Water Management Plan that we've summarized in Chapter 2. The Delta is severely threatened, and by climate change, but by earthquakes and other things as well. So we have some real impacts. We have, finally, human impacts. The vulnerability, again, is going to vary from whether you have insurance or not, whether you have good health to begin with or not, whether you have air conditioning or not. The impacts are going to hit different communities in different ways. And this study by the Pacific Institute, these are all studies that we're putting highlights from, talks to those issues. The good news, and I'll wrap up here, the good news is that we have a number of projects. It's a small number at this point, but we're moving ahead in the region. There are groups like BCDC and City of Hayward. And that third bullet down was the call from the Moore Foundation and Silicon Valley Leadership Group with Senator Feinstein about raising $1 billion for levee construction. We have a number of interesting projects around sea level rise, also a number of groups and projects now. We have the North Bay Climate Adaptation Initiative working on ecosystems impacts in the North Bay. We have a series of water projects. Water agencies, especially the larger ones like SFPUC, are doing their own studies, looking at their own water supplies and modeling different results looking ahead. We have a whole slew of energy projects in the region that will make us more resilient and help us reduce our energy costs and make us more locally self-sufficient. And finally, a lot of disaster resilience preparation work and thinking, which is a good part of this. Some of this is going to come in slow change, and some of it's going to happen in big whopper events. And so ABAG's Regional Disaster Resilience Initiative is going to be very key to that, the latter, to how we deal with major extreme storms, how we deal with events that happen in our region. This is the conclusion from the State of California's recent look at all of what we're doing. And it's good news and bad news. The good news is we don't lack technical solutions. We have plenty of them, and our Chapter 3 starts to summarize and talk about what we can do. But we have some significant barriers for adaptation planning and for eventually implementation, and they are institutional, they are motivational, and they are economic primarily, and that's from the Mosier study. And that's what our project is really about, is about getting at those barriers. It's not about solving the technical problems. That's going to be up to water agencies and various other groups to put together. But our work is really around how can we help with the institutional and the motivational and the economic issues. So finally, last slide. We took this on with you as one of the two leadership projects, meaning it's the JPC stepping into this void regionally and seeing what it can do with this project to help, again, cities and counties and others in the region who are trying to move forward who will eventually move forward with adaptation work. But there are benefits to our four agencies right now, and I've put just four of them up there that I thought were most important. We are going to be helping cities and counties and providing them with assistance that's going to help them start on this work when they're ready to start. We're going to be increasing support for strategies that may be a little tough, like the sea level rise strategy, and for other measures that we're going to start working on in the region over the next few years. Our project is to get ahead of that some and do some of the groundwork and lay the foundation so people understand the issues better and we get more buy-in and we get more support in the region. It won't be unanimous, but get enough support to move forward with some of these things. We'll certainly be providing this kind of research data and all as input to the SCS, particularly to the second SCS. And finally, there'll be direct benefits. For instance, if we can work on the urban heat island impacts, and you can do that within a region. This isn't like climate change globally where we do our part but everybody else has to. We can do some things in the region about urban heat islands that would change, reduce ozone formation, would promote public health and help out with some of those extremely hot days and hot nights, and also reduce energy use. So that's my report, and I'll take questions if you have them.
Thank you, Bruce. Any questions or comments for Bruce? Yes, Mr. Haggerty.
I was wondering, Bruce, if it would be possible to get copies of what's been passed around. It's kind of hard to peruse it that quickly as we're trying to make sure everybody else gets a chance to see it. So I don't know if it's an email form and you can email it and we can print it or what. But and also, it would have been helpful for us as you were going through the slides to really have the slides, because trying to look up there and look at the dots was pretty tough. And I think the information that you were giving us was pretty good. So
good.
I that's in Chapter 1.
Yeah.
Most of that data. So I really think getting that sent to us is important.
Excellent. Two quick answers. The I didn't pass it out to everybody today because it's a draft, and we're finishing it next Wednesday, and we'll distribute it, Mr. Haggerty, then when we get the final done, and we'll post it on the web. The other is we're going to be boiling some of the most important findings, which I tried to show you a few of, into a 4-to-6-page setup. And so we're going to be working on that over the next month or two, and I think that'll be easier than everybody trying to comb through and find. But we'll do both.
Okay. Great. Mr. Green.
That one slide that talks about the institutional, motivational, and economic hurdles to get over, did that report have any suggestions as to how to cure at least the first two? I mean, you know, money is money, but as far as the institutional and motivational, any suggestions off of Moser there?
They're releasing their report on July 31st, so we've only seen the executive summary, and yes, it does include ideas and the usual. You know, we have to think creatively about finance here is probably number one. You know, this is going to be a tough deal in any sort of economy and in any sort of state for our local and regional finance. So creative financing, working with the state on that's going to be interesting. The institutional stuff is a lot of what we're going to try and get at with our project. You know, what's the best mix of state and region and local here to work together efficiently? So far, it's been three parallel tracks, which is not very efficient. So I can tell you more when Mosher's report comes out. We'll bring it here. We could bring Susie here, actually, to talk with you. She's quite good. And I should have recognized that we had four of our JPC members at the workshop, Mr. Wasserman, Mr. Ross, Mr. Kinsey, and Mr. Joya were all there. And Susie Mosher was, I think, quite persuasive and helpful there, and she's the person who did this study.
I just have a quick question, kind of following up on Mr. Green's. You know, the motivational part, would you also put the word emotional in there? And the reason I say that, if you've been at some of the hearings just on One Bay Area, if you start talking about climate change and greenhouse gas emissions, you know, those three items are great, but there's a very emotional side of really not believing, you know, all of this information. And it's a tough one because you want people's feedback. Not everybody's going to agree with everybody, but it's a very emotional sense we get from people that they're just not believing some of these things. And so I don't know if the motivational includes how do we get to people to recognize, you know, there's not a hidden agenda for the motivational. There's, you know, actual stats and you know.
It, again, was another part of our workshop where we spent probably close to an hour with a couple of the experts in the room talking about what's the research show us about how to get these messages across in a compelling fashion. Not easy.
Okay, let me start with Zach and then Jim and then Jake.
A couple of comments. The workshop was very good. One of the pieces of it that I thought was very important focused on the storytelling. It addresses a little bit of the emotional on the other side, but to make this effective, we need to make sure we have accurate, to the extent possible, but also good stories as we answer Mr. Sperling's questions. Second, I think the focus on this last slide is correct. But I think the technical solutions absolutely need to be closely woven in, partly because they're part of the story. The story in this whole campaign has to be a combination of fear and hope. And we really need to address hope. Technical solutions are going to be part of that. Plus, as we grapple with what will be the toughest part of this, which are the economics, how do we pay for it? Well, maybe the second toughest. The toughest may be avoiding unintended consequences. But the economic one is going to be critical. We need to have some idea of what those technical things are as we balance all of this. And I recognize the reality of foundation funding and that Kresge, like other foundations, wants sort of concrete steps before they commit to longer range things. But realistically, this is a 5-to-10-year campaign. not a 6 to 12 month campaign.
Sure.
When Trav and I talked with Adam Fried in New York City, who's Bloomberg's lead on all of this work, and they're way ahead. They're doing all sorts of things in New York City. Adam's first suggestion to us was something that he had learned the hard way. When he went out to talk to the 14 department heads or whatever it was in the city, he found out right away he had to start by telling them, this isn't something completely new and different you're going to be dealing with. You've always been looking at your infrastructure and assessing what the risks are to it. We're adding another column here to it, and they relaxed quite a bit. So I think, again, that's part of the message of starting to talk about what we would eventually do, even though we're not there yet, so people can see that we're not talking about turning the entire region upside down.
Mr. Spearing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have an appreciation that we're getting away from the sky is falling strategy, you know, because it's very difficult when you tell people about global warming. It's hard to see it changing before your eyes, and it's kind of a generational issue. And I think what we need to do is we really need to prepare, and when you say motivation, we need to prepare the next generation that this is a challenge that they're going to have. And, you know, I think the data is showing us that the planet is changing. And so, to me, that's where we really need to put the focus on the motivational. It's the next generation has got to start preparing, because the infrastructure is going to really start deteriorating, and the infrastructure deterioration is going to start matching up with the data that we're getting in the time frame. And so, and they're actually going to be able to see it. And so I think that's one place we need to put a focus. The other, Bruce, could you expand a little bit when you talk about identifying the most vulnerable? What does that mean when you make that statement?
Well, I said a little bit about it. There are probably two or three good studies in Chapter 1 looking at which will the impacts be the same across the region for our 7.5 million people, or will certain classes of folks and certain geographic areas and all get more impact than others, you know, have more of a vulnerability than others. And so a lot of the literature about this is about, as I said, people that don't have health insurance. If this adds, you know, a health problem from heat stroke or from vector-borne disease or whatever, they're in more trouble than those of us with health insurance. So that's the kind of example. Folks, people that don't have air conditioning will have a harder time when we have our heat waves that are coming, particularly in the warmer parts of the region. People who work outside will have a much harder time dealing with this than those of us who go from air-conditioned offices to maybe air-conditioned homes. So it's looking and seeing who's most vulnerable. BCDC's Adapting to Rising Tides project has done an analysis on this just on sea level rise and looking at more vulnerable communities within that stretch of the bay.
Some of the data is kind of counterintuitive. It looks like San Franciscans will find it more difficult to deal with high heat days than people in Fresno, even though the high heat days in San Francisco will probably be 30 degrees less than the high heat days in Fresno. And I attribute this to what I call the Woos factor. You have people that are simply not used to dealing with continuous plus 90 degree temperatures in San Francisco, but in Fresno they're dealing with it every day, and so when it gets up to 110, it's not too much different. Also, you already have cooling centers and you have emergency response in Fresno to deal with those high heat days. We don't have that in San Francisco.
I think Mr. Travis just called me a wuss. I'm a fog baby. Just kidding. Mr. McKenzie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, Sonoma County just got awarded a Strategic Growth Council $1 million grant to prepare a climate action plan, and we have our regional climate protection authority that has been working now for over 2 years. How are you anticipating being able to avoid duplication of efforts. This, to me, just looking very quickly at a number of the things you were talking about, there are so many items going on at the local level. Do you have a plan?
Yes. We have a plan, and that's a big part of what we're going to do with the Kresge grant. At our workshop, we had Santa Clara County, which also just got $1 million SGC grant to do climate planning, including adaptation planning. We had Sonoma County there. So I think we're aware of the major projects. They're mostly in Chapter 2 there. And we've got the personal contacts. That's one of our 20 stakeholder groups. They're all defined differently. One's going to be just those people who are starting major projects like that. So that's our hope. It's always a trick in this region, but our hope is to create something much more efficient.
Mr. Ross?
Thank you, Mark, from heat-hardened Contra Costa County. The word motivation, Madam Chair, when you talked about emotional, the word motivational, I think, might cover that, because people do look at what are the motives of government, you know, imposing upon me these draconian measures. And I think that you can diffuse that by showing the confluence, that we have a confluence of goals. One is, yes, environmental and public health, but it's also economic. And public health can be shown to be economic, too, with the reduction of cost to county hospitals, with emergency admissions and asthma and the like, and in general, air pollution costs that are attributed to public health costs in the Bay Area, which is about $24 billion if you reduce that, or if at least you keep that from rising, there's a savings there. But the economic aspect of it, showing that if you do energy efficiency and you do water efficiency, those are easy, low-hanging fruit that bring about not only reduction in GHGs, but also employment and job creation and general wealth in the Bay Area, self-contained wealth in the Bay Area, just doing those items. I think that's how we're going to have to sell, not sell it, but present it as a confluence of goals. And that would diffuse some of the emotional aspects of it, that there is something in here economic for everybody, and that you will benefit economically, and this is just not some pie-in-the-sky environmental wacko, you know, dictum from central government.
Thank you for that lead, because we keep stressing over and over and over again, for the Bay Area, dealing with climate change is not an environmental issue. It's an economic imperative. If we want the region to remain competitive, we have to acknowledge the changes that we're going to have in the future and be prepared for them and adapt to them. And if we do that, we will create an environment where capital from throughout the world will continue to flow here, because they know it's a good place to invest.
And that is the first first task in the Kresge grant, is to take all this information that we have on science, of which we showed you a little, and on projects and on potential impacts, and create a story or a compelling storyline that we can use together and have more of a coherent and unified story.
Mr. Marr?
Yeah, I've never heard the wuss or wimp factor raised before, but I'll bring that back to the San Francisco City family as an issue. But I just wanted to say that I'm really pleased that there's a focus on seniors, low-income, and vulnerable populations that will be impacted differently than the general population. I really like that we're looking at food and water systems impacts, and how I know we are trying to create more local and regional food, but it sure seems like it's going to be impacted over the next period. I also like that it's very action-oriented, looking at the best research to figure out ways that local communities can be involved, especially the so-called social equity groups. And there's really good lists from Urban Habitat to many others that have ongoing projects at even the neighborhood level. So I'm really pleased about that. I also wanted to say that the white paper on the most vulnerable, I think, is really important, and I'll try to do my best to talk to organizations to be involved. I did hear that the June hearing needed better representation from different groups, and I'll try to do what I can to raise awareness in the San Francisco area and the East Bay kind of with the groups that I work with. But I'm very pleased with this, and I'm so glad that it's really focused on action that people can take now as we prepare for the future. But thank you, Mr. Reardon.
Okay, any other further comments, questions? Okay, well, thank you. Thank you, Bruce. That was very helpful. I'm going to go back, since we do have a quorum, and go to item number two, which is the approval of Joint Policy Committee meeting minutes for May 18, 2012.
So moved.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, seeing none. We will then move into item number four, progress report on regional economic development strategy framework. Where are we? Oh, there. Mr. Randolph. I'm not a band.
Thanks very much, Madam Chair. Just to follow up on Bruce's comments, I had the pleasure, the lack of pleasure of being in Washington, D.C. twice in the last 4 weeks, and it was pretty remarkable. When I left there yesterday morning, it was 100 degrees, having been 95 to 100 for about three continuous weeks. And 3 weeks ago, as we were flying out, this massive windstorm came in that everybody probably heard about, took down enormous number of trees. It's like a wall of wood, moving debris. A lot of the region was without power for 5 to 6 days. And talking with people this week about it, they said, well, you know, just imagine they're sitting in their homes, or not sitting in their homes, 100-plus degrees, day after day after day after day, without power or light or air conditioning. And a lot of offices just closed. A lot of people who could get out got out of town. Why sit in the dark in 100 degrees? But, of course, a lot of people couldn't get out of town. A lot of folks who didn't have the means to go off and stay with friends or go to a hotel somewhere else were stuck in those conditions. Heard a lot of stories about people going and sitting in their cars to run the air conditioning, then the cars would run out of gas. And not every city or sub-region in the area was affected for the same amount of time in terms of power. So you couldn't go to gas stations, a lot of areas, to get your car filled up to run the air conditioning because you had no power to pump the gas. But those communities that did have power, the gas stations ran out of gas because everybody was driving there to find gas to run their car air conditioners. So pretty extraordinary stuff, and yesterday it was 100 degrees and 90 degrees at night. So going to your point, Bruce, it was not cooling off at night. So granted, the meteorological conditions there are really different from here, you know, thank God. There's all kinds of implications and things that can happen from these kinds of extreme events and from extended heat that we're certainly seeing in a lot of the country right now. So on the economic side, I'd like to just bring you up to speed on the economic study that we're doing for the JPC. When we were together in May, I was able to present some preliminary data. And what I'll do this morning is give you a bit more of that. We've had three people continuously working on this before that and ever since. Patrick Kellerman, who's sitting there, is pretty much on it full time now and will be for the next 6 weeks or so. And can give you also a sense of the kind of business community response that we've gotten as we've shared the data with companies and done interviews with them about their perceptions of some of the issues that the report is raising. So if we go to the next slide, Bruce. So the findings lump themselves into these major categories: what's going on in the region, industry trends, establishments, but it's really businesses. Are businesses being formed? Are they dying off? Are they moving? Labor force and human capital, how people are commuting around the region, physically moving, some thoughts about the future, and then business community perspectives. And what we have at the moment, which we're not sharing, is a a big, thick stack of data. It's just dense and probably impenetrable. And what I'm going to do in the next 4 to 6 weeks is sort through that. Like, what's the most important stuff that would be valuable to you? Try to draw forward the top-end conclusions, the main ideas, and with suggestions for where we go from there. So that's, as we sort through this, we'll be reorganizing it and focusing it so it'll be as digestible and clear as it possibly can be. So the next slide. Just a little bit of something on the population question. So about 7.1 million people, this is four times the number of people we had in 1940. It's a huge growth. If you look at the next little bit of information, though, the built-up area where a certain percentage of every square mile has structures on it, and the growth of population relative to the growth of the built-up area, we actually have been growing in a rather dense way. In other words, we have not sprawled at the same rate that the population has grown. There has been a progressive densification here in the Bay Area, which does connect to the goals and discussions around the SCS. Next slide. And this gives a bit more feel about population density. Again, you can see the upward line, the dark, heavy one in the middle is the Bay Area, and we have been getting pretty much progressively denser in terms of residents per square mile within the 9-county area. So this is inclusive of the boundaries of the 9 Bay Area counties. Next. So people are obviously concerned about employment. You can see the most interesting lines. The top one is population. The middle one, the dotted line, is the labor force. And then employment is the bottom line. And you can see historically, you go from left to right, that there is sort of a zone fairly even. It varies a little bit between the labor force, which is always bigger than employment, and employment. What we start to see here about the time of the big recession, 2008, a very sharp diversion between the labor force and employment. And that's our situation today. We're beginning to close it a little bit in the last year, but we have an unprecedented gap between our labor force and the number of jobs that we're generating here in the Bay Area. So I think that's a lot of what our conversation about the economy and where it's going to go is going to revolve around. Next. Looking at sort of the industrial composition here in the region, so we're very diverse. We've got large retail and wholesale industries, legal professional, a lot of stuff. Where a lot of the growth areas are, the stronger industry focal points, are information. And, of course, that includes your Twitters and your social media companies and a lot of the stuff happening not just south of Market in San Francisco but all around the region. The computer industry, and that actually includes production of semiconductors and a lot of things related to the computer sector, the high-tech sector, very major economic contributors, sort of the leading edge, along with information of where the economy goes these days. General manufacturing, we have a good amount of. We're just calling out wine and food because that has been a relatively strong area within the manufacturing area. And then this very broad category of professional, technical, and scientific services, which is a lot of people in the technical area, the consulting area, the business professional area. There's a lot of biotech in there, a lot of software in there as well. So we'll call out a lot more industries in as much detail as we can. But I think those are four that will be focal points of the next phase of the study. Next. So establishments, which really means business establishments, and I'll show another slide or two on this, but you saw this the last time, that when we look at job creation and job destruction, which lets us know how many jobs do we have and are we growing them and are we not growing them, that more than half of the jobs that are created come from new companies being formed, new businesses. And even more of the jobs that we lose are coming because businesses that are already up and running close. A very small percentage of jobs in the area actually come, of new jobs, because companies have moved into the Bay Area from outside of the Bay Area or outside of California. Now, those can be significant companies, and they come in for a range of significant regions. But companies moving here from elsewhere, it's a pretty small sliver of the job creation process. And a relatively small amount, 4%, it's considerable, but still a relatively small number of the jobs we lose are because companies move out or because companies that are already here hire people outside of the Bay Area as opposed to here. I think what that might be pointing us toward in the conclusions would be thinking about economic development strategies, that competitive economic strategies between cities or counties to try to get a company to move from here, rather to get companies to move from outside the U.S., or well, outside of California into the Bay Area, or from anywhere else in the U.S., from L.A., from San Diego, move in the Bay Area, where a lot of economic development activity has been historically focused, isn't likely to yield the biggest results. You can be wildly successful at that and maybe get some really pivotal key companies, not to say it's not worth doing, but if you want to impact at a significant scale jobs and job creation, historically, and these are pretty good historical figures as well, that hasn't been a big source of jobs. The bigger and better focus is probably going to be, and we'll try to build this out for you, how can you make this an even stronger place for companies to be formed? And there, we have some data that show actually more companies get formed in L.A. and San Diego than get formed here relative to the size of the region. And once they're formed, what can we do to make it more likely that they will be successful and survive and grow and hire people and less likely relatively that they are going to fail over time? Some will always fail. But are there conditions we can address in the region that will help them and make it more likely that they will not fail and they will hire people in larger numbers? Next. And so these are just the pie charts. You saw things pretty close to this last time in terms of most of the jobs being created. That's the blue, being from companies that are formed here within the region. Most of the jobs that are lost are companies closing down that have been up and running, and a pretty small slice from companies moving in. I think one of the things on the companies moving in we'll want to look at is who is moving in and why are they moving in. I suspect pretty strongly, because there's plenty of evidence for it, that they're coming in, of course, to be part of the innovation technology economy. In a lot of ways, in the Bay Area, it's a place where if you want to be at the leading edge of that industry, that sector, especially social media these days, you want to be in the Bay Area. You want to have a presence here. And we know there's a trend of companies, especially new young entrepreneurial companies, coming into the Bay Area from around the world because it's the place to be. So these are high potential companies in terms of growth. But I think we just need to be thoughtful and focused about why companies choose or would want to come to the Bay Area and leverage off our strengths for how we try to attract them. Then the next slide gets us, as we were saying before, the jobs that go away, they're killed off. Overwhelmingly, it's companies that are already underway here closing. It tends to happen within 2 to 3 years. You have typically a spurt of growth initially. A 1 or 2 or 3 or 5 person grows to 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 or more. And then there's this critical period, 2 to 3 years, at which point either they make it or they don't. And a pretty big number, of course, don't. So what can we do to help them be more successful And we'll have a few suggestions in the study at the end for things that might be done at a government, at a regulatory level. Next. Labor force, one of our big advantages, one of the reasons people come into the Bay Area, is we do have an extraordinarily qualified and skilled labor force in the area. It's becoming more educated over time relative to the United States and relative to where it was in the past. So 42% of our workforce has a bachelor's degree or higher. It's much higher than for the U.S. as a whole, which is 28%. And that's an advantage for us here as we think about the industries we could attract or the industries we want to build here with that as a major competitive asset. Next one. And this, we'll have it clear so you can see it, but we'll be able to map out where this is concentrated, where you find the highest concentration of people within the region with these kinds of advanced degrees, which correlates pretty much, but not entirely, to where technology companies are located. Next. So that's one side of the coin. The other side is what I think we're all concerned with, too, which is there are an awful lot of people who do not have bachelor's degrees or master's or PhDs who are not earning that $125,000 a year that a new software engineer is going to get working for a social media company. So we're mapping out where they are physically located, where those communities are concentrated, as a way to start to focus on services for them. And when we think about the SCS, proximity of these communities to public transportation and proximity of these communities to both current job centers and potentially growing job centers, which does relate also to access to public transportation. So we're starting to work in an LMI perspective into this. Next. This is just a little quick slide. We got a ton of these, one for every county, in fact. And I think you saw a slide of this in May, that a very large percentage of the population here, the workforce, commutes across county lines. This is just for San Francisco. It shows where workers in San Francisco come from. For every county, we'll have a map of showing the density in other parts of the region for where the workforce in that county actually resides. Next. So looking ahead, this has some interesting implications. Everybody, I think, knows that the U.S. population, our population here, is getting relatively older. Looking at what, say, 2000 to 2010, and then the next 10 years, blue being the last 10, the brown being the next 10, you can see a drop in population in prime earning age categories, 35 to 54. And then a lower number of our share of our workforce being in that 55 to 64 category, which is probably the highest earning group in the population base. And a very big growth in the share of our population that is aged 65 to 74 and 75 plus.
I guess, Sean, what I was wondering is, a few slides back, you showed the level of degrees. I think it was like 42%. Do you lay those level of degrees over those ages to see if we're actually losing the degrees, also the educational factor?
We haven't, but we can try to do that. There's a lot of
It would be interesting to see that, to see if we're actually going to gain the educational advantage or lose it.
There's a bunch of things that go in that education pot. So one is, I think as you're pointing out, Scott, as people retire, we tend to have a very educated workforce, and they will have to be replaced. Will they be replaced by people at the same skill or educational level? And that backs you into a bunch of other issues. Are we in California, in the Bay Area, generating out of, say, the University of California, CSU, and community colleges, people in sufficient number with those skills to replace the people who are leaving the workforce? And unfortunately, this gets us into trends in public support for higher education in the state at all three levels, UC, CSU, and community colleges, where we're seeing dramatic cutbacks in the levels of public support, class sizes going down, tuition going up, people taking, instead of 4 or 5 years, taking 5 or 6 years to complete the degrees because they can't get the classes anymore, and a whole series of unfortunate things. Plus, we've relied in the region more than anywhere else in the country on skilled, educated people coming in from outside the U.S. on H-1B visas, eventually getting green cards, who have played really enormous roles in starting companies. They have a much higher propensity than people born here to start companies, and a lot of those have become major employers. It has become harder over time for them to come in because of caps on green cards. So we're sort of caught between these two negative influences now when we look at that retiring workforce. A, where the trend line is we are not generating, and we're not on track to generate people out of our higher education system level with that education and those skills, and we're actually restricting the same path of pipeline that we've relied on to cover some of the gap of people who've come in from outside the U.S. So it's a really significant issue.
It was interesting when you showed that demographic about the college education. I noticed that just being parochial, I noticed the Berkeley dot was about three times the size of the Palo Alto dot. Yeah, go Bears. But I then thought, well, why is that? And it probably is that the people that are educated at the public universities may be staying locally, more likely to stay local than when they go to Stanford, they get their degree and they go somewhere else. Because I noticed it was Sand Hill Road had a few of the dots there, but mostly I was surprised that it wasn't a bigger red dot in the South Bay, but up in Berkeley and along the East Bay Corridor, it seemed to be larger. So it kind of augurs to what you were saying, that it sounds like the public university graduates may be sticking around and adding to the wealth of education and knowledge here in the Bay Area, whereas some of the private universities may be exporting their graduates back to wherever they came from.
And it could also be, Mark, that Berkeley is just a much bigger university. There's just a lot more people. And
I think it's a better school.
Well, won't go there. There's a scale question.
I may have missed it, but what's the extra name from Georgia?
The 35 to 54 drop.
I think there are, we'll have to kind of pin this down, but I think there are population cycles. There are points when a lot of people are having kids, and you have bulges in the K-12 system, and they kind of work their way through like through a snake or something. And then you have drops and cycles. So my guess is that may be catching part of a demographic cycle of when people are having families. But we'll figure that out. Next. And so ignore the bars to the left. It sort of gets a little bit complicated. Just comparing the Bay Area, California, United States. So we're actually likely, we think, to grow jobs at a better rate here than the rest of California and actually the rest of the country. And some of that goes back to the nature of the workforce being a comparatively competitive and well-educated workforce, our heavy grounding in all kinds of technology and things you could lump into a bigger pot called innovation, which is, I think, positions the Bay Area from a competitive standpoint well compared to almost anywhere else in the state or the country. So, again, when we get closer to thinking about conclusions and growing jobs, I think that may help to focus it. But compared to almost anywhere else in the country, I think our outlook for our potential to grow jobs is relatively strong. Next. So as I mentioned, we as we're gathering the data, we started to talk to businesses, and we conducted 75 interviews with businesses around the region, and they were selected both to have representation on a weighted basis from every county, representation on an industry basis, so it wouldn't be all property developers or all biotech people, and weighted toward size of companies, so we would have some mix of large companies, medium companies, and small companies. And the vast majority of the folks who we connected with were founders, owners, presidents, or senior managers in their firm, so in a position to speak with some authority on behalf of their companies. Next. So there's a lot of data coming out of that that we'll cook and slice and dice for you, but just a couple of top-line things coming out of that. In terms of how they were doing, just as businesses right now, it was a pretty mixed picture. About 20% had grown in the last 3 years. About an equal number, more or less, had declined, and roughly half had held even. So, you know, it's been a pretty volatile time. I think if we did this series of questions 2 or 3 years ago, we would have shown more companies had shrunk and very few had grown. But I think we've been in this transition from a negative to a more positive trend, so it's pretty much mixed. Over that period, again, focusing on employment is a key thing, very modest growth in employment. Positive growth, but 1.8% growth in employment is not what I think anybody would hope for or look for. So that's problematic. And it goes back to that slide we saw earlier with that unprecedented gap between labor force size and actual employment. The good news is we seem to be at the moment on the positive end of a trend of employment growth with some positive momentum. I mean, not dramatic, but pretty positive. About half of the companies who we talked to said they were planning to increase their employee count. Only a tiny number said they were planning to shrink their payrolls, and about half said they expected to keep it the same. But with close to half saying they were planning to increase employment, again, that would point to a pretty positive trend for at least the next year or two in the region. Next. A little bit more mixed on the views of the business climate. You know, climate being the environment for doing business when you kind of wrap everything in. Most of the folks we talked to, like 56%, thought the region was a pretty good place to do business. About 28% thought it was fair, and a small number thought it wasn't great, but you know, if you lump in good to fair, it was a pretty good view of this, for whatever collection of reasons, as a good place to do business. The business climate, it's a little bit different than a place to do business. It sort of includes more regulatory and other issues that we'll get into in a half a second here. But still, the largest group of companies were satisfied with it, and about an even number were kind of neutral or unhappy, but pretty mixed, but on the balance, more positive than negative. It becomes a little bit more negative when you get into the regulatory areas, which shouldn't be terribly surprising. Sort of a balance, more or less, between those who were satisfied and those dissatisfied and those neutral, but it was sort of the most negative category of the questions that we asked. We didn't find a whole lot of unhappiness when we talked about infrastructure, although when we talked about, you know, people at BART, things like that, they were pretty happy. When you started to ask about roads and bridges, oh, they got less happy about that. But, you know, a general level of, you know, no great unhappiness about infrastructure, at least the people we were able to reach. Generally satisfied with access to capital. I think among smaller companies you'd find more with problems, but generally pretty satisfied with access to capital. Next. We wanted to ask them, like, are you aware of regional agency plans, like One Bay Area and the Sustainable Community Strategy? And over 60% of the companies had no idea. About 40% said, yeah, we know about those things. But it turns out what they were thinking of was plans for high-speed rail or plans for vehicle charging stations in their community. They were not thinking about the SCS or other ABAG and Plan Bay Area, One Bay Area kind of plans. So there was a real gap in awareness of what the agencies are doing, and of course of how those plans would impact them as businesses. And then the other thing that came out of the interviews, and this really was more in the regulatory area, was sort of frustration, not with the idea of regulation as much as, I think, at the planning level, lack of consistency between regulations. And the fact that there's a perception of unnecessary overlap between regulatory requirements at the city and the county, the regional and the state level, where I think a lot of people see just a lot of layers of things they have to go through that could be more consistent, they could be more streamlined, they could be managed in a way that involve fewer costs for them as businesses to comply. So there was a real clear message of looking for greater integration and greater consistency of regulation across the board within the region. Next. Then there were a few other things coming out of it. A significant number, 62%, said they've got problems finding the kind of workforce, the kind of people they need with the skills they need for the workforce. There was concern with K-12 education, you know, pretty good satisfaction with university, but concerned with K-12, low level of satisfaction with how that's performing. The quality of life in the Bay Area ranked really high. People seemed to feel, whatever else was going on, that we've got a great quality of life, and that was a big differentiator for the Bay Area compared to anywhere else. And another thing that it's not on the slides, but it turns out that the decisions that when we ask companies, why are you in the Bay Area? Why did your company get started in the Bay Area? The biggest one answer was the founder lived here. There are other things, workforce and a variety of close to universities and good stuff like that. But why did the company get going? The founder lived here. And then why is your company still in the Bay Area? The biggest answer was still the founder lives here. You know, workforce and other things, regulatory things, they show up more about why are you still here. But I think it does point to the fact, two things. One, as we found earlier, that most of the companies created, the jobs created, are created by companies that are already here, by people who are already here. But also the satisfaction, the perception of key individuals, the founders of these companies, who are very often still the managers and leaders of the companies, is really critical because they largely have the ability to decide, is my company going to stay here? Am I going to hire my next block of workers, my next call center, my next production facility? Will that be in the Bay Area or not? So a lot of this does come down to the personal decisions of leaders of the companies who were the founders or are the founders. And right now, again, quality of life is a big differentiator on the positive side for the region with everything that goes into quality of life. So the last slide is where we're going. So we've got this great, big, thick, massive pile of documented slides and data that we need to kind of make digestible. When we get it a little more presentable, we want to sit down with anybody in the JPC and the agencies. We've been talking with Trav about this and with Bruce. We want to share that with you to make sure we're tagging the issues correctly and adequately that you want us to address, including drawing out perspectives on low and moderate income communities, the connections to the sustainable community strategy, and I think we've heard before that we want to have some connection or focus on what's happening with small business. We'll do the same with the business organizations, get their perspective, come up with a cleaner draft. Right now, we've targeted a release to have this ready to go in print by September 6th. Wise Technologies, which is a tech company down in San Jose, has offered to host it for us. They hosted Gavin Newsom, the release of Gavin Newsom's California Economic Development Strategy last year. They did a great job, very gracious, and beautiful grounds and facilities and great lunch and stuff. So we're looking at September 6th, and we'll work with Trav and Bruce and you about both getting the report ready to go, ready for prime time between now and then, consult directly on the next to final draft, and also look to getting as many people as would like to participate in that event to the table at that event.
Excellent. Mr. Hagerty and then Mr. Green have comments.
Thank you. I want to go back to that 42% of higher educated workforce for a second. As I was sitting here, and hopefully I can articulate this, but as I was watching you go through the slides and listening, if people are coming here because it is a more educated workforce, my concern being that they come here looking for that educational group, but because of high land costs and because these businesses are looking for the more educated person, what happens to the jobs for those people who maybe have high school, a year of college, or maybe just high school? I mean, are those people being squeezed out because of the lack of education and also the high land costs? And then that concerns me that, you know, we've got this whole socioeconomic group or sector that's being squeezed out of the area.
Right. That goes to the one slide we had up on the low and moderate income communities and where they're located. I think it's we will go deeper into this. I don't think that the people coming into the area with these high levels of education are displacing people here. It's clear that in an already high-cost housing environment, the cost of housing is being bid up a lot. And I think the argument can be made that as they come in and these companies grow, they will be hiring more people at all levels. But then the question, I think there's issues at several levels. One is, do we have the housing at the right price points available for everybody? Because we obviously need everybody. And are we actually generating people with not the master's PhD skills, or even the bachelor's skills, but people with community college level or below who are actually employed? And this sort of gets us into these K-12 issues, but maybe more immediately workforce training, workforce development issues, how the community colleges are working or not working to fill that. It's a real concern that we don't want to have the region focused on, the strategy focused just on the high end, because that leaves an awful lot of people out who, many of whom can benefit by company growth as companies hire, but if they don't have the skills, the skills to be hired even at a technical level, then we've got a real problem. And the housing issue is a housing issue. I've been struggling with that for a long time and have to work that into, as well as the access to public transit to get to where the jobs are being created.
I just think that everything you just said further speaks to the fact that inadvertently, we probably are squeezing these people out. And I mean, a good case in point, I mean, there's not a whole lot of warehousing jobs and things like that around this area anymore. They've all left and gone to Tracy and East or whatever. And I don't know. I think, you know, we need to look at ourselves and see how we, and maybe you're doing this, Sean, through your work, you know, but we need to look at how we can retain good, lower-paying jobs. So to try to match people, their jobs with their educational status, keeping them, and maybe that's working more with like labor and trying to develop trade schools and things like that. Maybe incentives for warehousing type jobs. I mean, we have to get back into that business, and I really believe we're just really squeezing people out.
There, I've heard it said, I mean, especially in Berkeley, which Tom was here for this, that there's pressure on property currently zoned as industrial for housing. So we've got this issue too about developing enough housing at the right prices, but as the housing need expands, it's putting pressure on land that could be used for industrial purposes. So what's the future actually of industrial production going to be in the Bay Area? Because that used to be a big source of jobs for people with, you know, bachelor's degree or less. And if we look at what's happened to jobs over the last 20 or 30 years, but especially in the last 10 years, 10 to 12, since 2000, there's been a precipitous drop in every kind of production job throughout the region. I think food production may have gone up a little bit because of the wine industry, but any kind of industrial production, we've seen actually a fairly healthy manufacturing sector as a share of the economy, but those companies, for a variety of reasons, are each one employing a lot fewer people. They're employing fewer people. So you, that kind of thing.
Mark, I do want to be mindful of our time, too, because we're supposed to end at 12, so I'm going to keep going. Mark?
You mentioned access to capital, infrastructure, but only talking about roads there rather than energy. Sean, I don't know if you had any feedback on energy costs, because I've had that in other places in Union City, that the cost of energy is a detriment. And you mentioned regulation, but was taxation a question? Besides energy costs, was taxation a question? And then this interesting dichotomy of, we had the most educated workforce, and yet they're saying that the biggest problem is getting the right people. That workforce was the biggest problem. So, yeah. So those three points.
Quick answers to those, Mark. The on the taxation, we did have questions, and taxation was not a high issue for most of the companies we talked to. You know, you're always going to find people who think they're too high, but it didn't come out that taxation is our biggest issue. The workforce, the having this large qualified workforce, but a shortage of people, it actually does make a certain sense, because we do have probably the biggest pool in the U.S. of people like this. We have more demand than anywhere else in the U.S. So a lot of the companies come here for that workforce. A lot of the companies are created out of it, but these people are being bid up as fast as they show up, and so companies. I was doing a little bit of digging the other day for something on visas, H-1B visas. A typical company, 150 employees, relatively new. They're in the social media space. 150 employees, 30% of their positions are vacant, and they can't fill them. They're recruiting nationally. They're recruiting in India. They can't fill the positions. They're looking for very specific skills. But so it's a function of, there's a big pool, but there's this growing demand, but it's demand for specific kinds of skills.
We can
take a look at that.
Okay. Mr. Spearing, and then I might also ask if there's anybody here from the business community that wanted to make any comments on this.
Okay. I just want to follow up on Scott Haggerty's comments, and I hope you can drill down a little bit deeper on that high school issue, you know, because I think it's important that the high school graduates or the people that aren't going to college, it seems like, I agree, they are being forced out. You know, when you look at this high level of education, but yet we have some of the highest levels of people on public assistance. And so there's a disconnect. And one of our cities just took applications for public works maintenance worker, and over 50% of the applicants were college graduates. And so you can see who's applying for those jobs. You know, 10 years ago, you wouldn't have had one. And so, you know, the high school graduates, you know, they are being squeezed out. And the other, it's you know, when I look at all that data and I think of what's going on in Solano County, there's one hell of a disconnect, you know. So, you know, as you look at the region, it's one thing, but, you know, for our sub-region, it's much different than what you're showing in your numbers, you know, our unemployment rate and the people who are getting the jobs, the type of jobs that are being created. And I this dropout rate in high schools is becoming a very serious problem. As we interview people that are looking to locate either in Solano County, you know, as a supervisor that I talked to, they raise that issue. They say we see the dropout rate is so high, and they're concerned about that. And they do talk about the regulatory control. You know, one gentleman sitting in my office talking about he can get a permit in Texas in 6 months, you know, in Solano County for the type of industry. It was almost 2 years. And so it's those types of dynamics that, you know, we really need to look at and look at a little bit closer. But I really do believe that we have to start talking about the people that either can't afford to go to college or don't go to college. How do we match up those skills to the potential jobs, you know, and how do we start changing, you know, how we're educating young people so they do have opportunities with the jobs that we can create in the Bay Area, because we're going to have a large number of people that don't have that college degree, at least in their earlier work life. And so I think we have to take serious consideration as to how we place these people, or that public assistance issue is going to become much greater and greater.
Thank you, Jim. Any other comments from the commission? Are any business individuals that wish to make any comment? Okay, seeing none, I think we'll conclude with this. Thank you very much. That was excellent.
Oh, by the way, we will have county-by-county tables. So this is just a high-end regional perspective. For every issue, there will be a county table.
Can I make one comment? One of the things that I always concern myself with, too, we have a lot of the community colleges that are doing some training programs, but are we connecting with the businesses to find out what their needs are 5 years out? Do we keep training for the things that are going to be obsolete in a year or two? And so I do think there's a little bit of that disconnect. And I'll give you an example in our county. The auto industry is having trouble getting mechanics and all. But, you know, so are we training people in that area that will actually have jobs that are going to be available? So there's a real disconnect there. So they're having a huge difficulty finding mechanics, but yet there's a lot of individuals that probably could get trained in that really aren't going to be your bachelor's or master's individuals. So anyway, I just think maybe it's the businesses that we need to reach out to give us more information of what their future needs are, too, rather than waiting, you know, to say, well, we don't have a workforce. So, I mean, it's kind of a proactive direction I think we need to take, and that's what we're working on in our county, as a matter of fact. Well, I'm going to have us move on to item number 5. We have about 15 minutes, so I know Will will talk fast.
I will. As you know, Senator Mark DeSaulnier attended your last JPC meeting on May 18th to discuss SB 1149, which he had introduced to restructure the JPC and to require you to take on a number of responsibilities, including the preparation of a 20-year regional economic development strategy. And at that meeting, Senator DeSaulnier provided a list of 5 objectives, which he said were the principles he hoped to achieve through the passage of SB 1149. One of these objectives is the preparation of a 20-year economic development strategy. Well, you had a lively discussion with him, and he offered to withdraw SB 1149 and to meet with your executive committee to discuss how the 5 principles could best be achieved. Well, he did suspend action on SB 1149, but without further discussion with you or your executive committee, he then amended another bill he had introduced, SB 878, to require you to prepare 2 detailed reports and a 20-year regional economic development strategy. Chair Bates informed the legislature that the JPC couldn't undertake these additional responsibilities without financial support from the state, something SB 878 did not provide. Senator DeSaulnier then removed these new mandates from SB 878, and as a result, at this time, there is no pending legislation that deals with the 5 principles the senator identified as his objectives. He intended to meet with your executive committee on July 9th, and unfortunately, a last-minute obligation prevented him from attending that meeting. The senator does plan to attend your next full JPC meeting on September 21st and has offered to meet with your executive committee before then, if that's advisable. At its July 9th meeting, in the senator's absence, your executive committee decided to move ahead with a discussion of the five principles that the senator had advanced, so any further consideration of them could reflect how the JPC believed they could best be accomplished. We provided you with a report summarizing that discussion, which focused largely on the 20-year regional economic development strategy, because that idea seems to be of greatest interest to the senator. The culmination of this discussion was the unanimous passage of a motion calling for two things. First, the executive committee requested that we invite business community representatives to attend today's meeting so they could hear the status report that you just heard and share their perspectives with you. We made that invitation, and there are representatives from the business community here today. Second, the executive committee recommended that you should direct Bruce and me, along with the agency staff, to work with the business community in drafting an action plan that assesses what elements should be included in a regional economic development strategy, the likely costs of formulating such a strategy, and the potential sources of funding for such work. We believe this is a sound recommendation. It does not endorse a regional economic strategy, nor does it commit the JPC to formulating such a strategy. Rather, it's aimed at determining the scope, the content, the cost, and the funding for a regional economic development strategy. However, we believe the scoping work should not be initiated until the regional economic development strategy framework has been completed, and as Sean said, it will be rolled out in September. We can then use that framework as the foundation for our analysis. So that completes our report. Bruce and I are available to respond to questions, and Mr. Wasserman, I believe, was the author of the motion that was unanimously passed. So if you have any questions as to its intent, he can respond far better than I can.
So let me see if I can clarify. You're asking us to take up what was recommended by the executive committee, but also not really start any of it till September after we get the economic development strategy framework.
That's exactly correct.
So that would really basically be the motion.
Yes.
If anybody's interested in that. What is the pleasure of the committee?
So moved.
I'll second that. I do have some comments.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. Do you want to make your comments before we vote on it?
Won't affect the vote, no.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? We're ready for your comments.
Several. I think that Will, as he occasionally does, exaggerated. I think there may be one representative from the business community in the room.
There's at least three
over here. Oh, there are three. I apologize. Okay. Then you didn't exaggerate. It
well,
was
three,
my miscounting.
Is three several or is it few?
It's a lot. It's a minor exaggeration.
It's a few.
I think the intent of the discussion at the executive committee, and certainly my motion, was that we need very serious dialogue with the business community, even in exploring how we're going to go down this path. And I would suggest that this forum is a bad forum for that kind of dialogue. Now, I know that Bruce and Will have met, I think on more than one occasion, with representatives of the Bay Area business groups, which are sort of as I think most of us know, if not all, starting to form together from Bay Area Council to East Bay EDA to jobs and housing to Silicon Valley. But I think that we should have at least one, if not more, of those discussions before the September meeting, recognizing that we're, you know, not there yet wherever we're going. But this has to be interactive. Part of that is that we need to figure out how to really get the business community's engagement. And I know a number of people around this table, myself included, have been struggling with that for a long time. There are moments in time when that communication is pretty good. Most of the moments, there isn't much communication. Your statistics about recognition of regional plans illustrates that. And we're not going to solve that. We're certainly not going to solve it overnight. But to make any progress on developing a regional economic plan, we've got to figure that out. And it may in part be who really leads that. There was significant discussion at the executive committee of whether JPC should lead that. It is not yet resolved. In terms of government agencies, at the moment, there probably isn't another one. Whether it should be government or should be more private or some existing public-private partnership, I think it also needs to be discussed. But we've got to get those discussions going step by step as we move forward.
Let me see if I understand. Are you talking about you want this group to meet with those individuals, or are you talking about having Sean and Will and others meeting with the business communities?
Primarily Sean and Will and Bruce.
Okay.
Although having a couple of representatives from this body there might make sense as well. The barriers to communication are on both sides of that table.
Well, maybe what we could do is when you are going to meet, perhaps let all of us know, and if it's convenient for any individuals to do that, I think that is worthwhile. So that's a good suggestion. Okay, we're now down to board comments. Any other comments, questions, concerns? Okay, seeing none, the next item is public comment. Any public comment? Seeing no one rushing to the podium, I think we'll adjourn. I made it before 12.